White Aryan Resistance calling. White Aryan Resistance calling. This is White Aryan Resistance, and this is Terrible Tommy. Tom Metzger right here in the bunker in north central Indiana with the news you choose. That's right. It's February the 10th, 2015. We're back here in the bunker. Tears Day. And we're, the moon is disappearing slowly. Yeah, and it's nice and warm here, I'll tell you. It's going to get up in the 50s today. All the snow is melting away, and all the little animals are coming out, and the birds are tweeting, and everybody's happy around here. But they weren't very happy in Tokyo about 70 years ago today when the glorious forces of America dropped firebombs on Tokyo, because Tokyo was, at that time, was a lot of light-made houses, and they burned very easily. So they decided they'd drop all these firebombs on the civilian population, and right away they'd run down and surrender. Well, that was a fallacy, because they didn't. But anyhow, another glorious historical event that I would just as leave forget. You see, there's a lot of people in this world that don't believe in personal or individual combat. They believe in killing hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands. They enjoy it. They hang out in Washington, hang out in a place called the Pentagon, and on Wall Street. Doesn't bother them that thousands of people, tens of thousands of people die. I get in Vietnam, what was it? A couple of million, 2.5 million, and of course it was, I think it was about 5,000 at least. No, maybe it's 20,000 GIs. Yeah. Oh boy, war is great, isn't it? War is great. I want to send all these senators and congressmen in a plane over there to the Middle East. Drop a mite right in the middle of the ISIL territory and tell them, there you go. Here's a rifle. Now, if you can fight your way out, that's it. You're free. If not, that's too bad. You know, I told you about this TV series, House of Cards. And I watched some of it last year. But it's a long series. I'm telling you, it's more graphic and more realistic every show I watch. Now, you can go down to the rental place and pick up like a whole season on DVD for about $3. Or if you're on Netflix, you can get it free. But I'm telling you, everybody should watch House of Cards, because that's exactly the way I see Washington being. In fact, I see all the state houses being like that. Maybe not exactly, but close. I see all the city councils sort of like that. It's always a power struggle for money, prestige, and power. And I would like to see all lone wolves watch that series, House of Cards, so you'll know how rotten, how depraved they are in Washington. In fact, they may pull back a few punches. It may be even worse than what that show puts on. Yep, that's the story. Well, we had this fraternity house out there in Oklahoma. They had a party, and they were on a bus going someplace, and they got into nigger talk. One of the frat mothers got involved. They got the camera right in her face. She said just exactly what she felt like saying. That's free speech. Well, she told them what she thought. Sorry, I couldn't turn the volume down. For some reason, they didn't have the volume thing on that clip, so anyhow, it probably blew your ears out, but she was just as happy as she could be, saying, nigga, 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 nigga.
Now's another white man. You guys, you know what I'm going to tell you? You guys tickle me. I'm going to explain something to you. See, I watch a white audience. I study them. And black performers, white people, they talk about Chinese, they talk about Mexicans, they talk about Indians, they talk about everybody. And you guys, your language, your thing, you're into it. Because I study, you're just laughing like you stare, and you just laugh. You have no sense of humor on you. You just, your whole body, you're into it. But the minute you talk about white folks, that bullshit just... Make that nigger. Stop saying nigger. I'm getting a nigger headache. I can't. Make the nigger stop saying nigger. White folks made up nigger and don't want me to say it. Ain't that a bitch? You made it up. You shouldn't have made it up. You fucked up. You shouldn't have made up nigger. And you made up a song to go with it. Please don't make me sing the song. Eeny, meeny, miny. You know the goddamn song I'm talking about. And you change the words when you see black folks. Catch a tiger. Have they gone? Hey, so you fucked up. I say nigga all the time. I say nigga 100 times every morning. It makes my teeth white. Nigga, 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 nigga. I say it, you think it, what a small white world. But you don't have any problem saying Arnold Schwarzenegger. I may not know about the space program, but I know nigga when I hear it. You guys love saying his name. Schwarzenegger. Oh, Arnold nigger. Oh, Mr. Nigger. Schwarzenegger. I didn't say it. I was hoping he'd marry Shirley Temple Black and she'd be Mrs. Shirley Temple Black nigger, but it didn't work out that way. Arnold Schwarzenegger. He's the only white man to make a movie that scared the fuck out of me. Terminator, that shit scared me. I had nightmares for 6 months. A white man that wouldn't die, that fucked me up. I threw my knife at the screen. Stab that motherfucker, stab him! He just kept coming, didn't he? Because white people are very sensitive, you have to remember that. Oh, they kill me with their sensitivity. So sensitive. It'll be some won't make this. Oh, they'll get out of here like little white bunny rabbits. They'll hop out of this motherfucker. This lady leaving now. Look at her. She's leaving now. Yeah. I hope when you get home, niggas are burglarizing your house. Good night, ma'am. They can't take it. I'm telling you, I know white folks. They can't take. She got the fuck out of here, didn't she? They can't take it. Because all of their lives, they've been told they're the shit. White people always show you're the best. You're everything. You're wonderful. You come from heaven. You're everything. You've never done nothing to nobody. You wear the white hat. You're the good fucking guy. And the minute they hear a nigga talk about it, freaks them. Because I study white folks. You can laugh at anybody. Because white folks will talk about a nigga. You'll laugh. And the minute it's about you, white, you get that fucking bag. That no sense of humor about yourself. Fuck you. You can be talked about, too. This is America. Fuck you. Fuck you. You can be talked about, too, motherfucker. And this, wait, and this white man is looking around thinking I got some kind of power over niggas. Oh, he has voodoo. He's looking around looking, and well, he's not Robin Williams. He's not that great. He has voodoo. This isn't fun. See, it ain't funny when it's about them. It is funny because you motherfuckers are some funny motherfuckers. Whether you know, that's why God sent me to tell you about white people. You some funny ass motherfuckers. Because you guys knock me out. You knock me out. Because it's just like with race. See, with race, white folks have been racist and against everybody. And running the shit, as long as they're in charge, it's cool. But if you try to be prejudiced or be racist, it is against God. You've broken the God. What do you mean? Now, justice. They won't take it for this much, but want you to take it all your life. So I don't give a fuck. Take it. You'll get over it. I got over it. Deal with it. Deal with it. I got over it.
Actually, he's talking about white liberals and conservatives because this is the way they are. Instead of flat out saying, well, hell yes, I'm a racist. I'm a racial separatist. And I don't want to integrate with blacks. They try to talk their way out of it or tell a joke or anything. Paul Mooney's pretty good at that. He calls them out. He's, I understand how black people feel about a lot of white people because they're such goddamn hypocrites, you know? Now, the woman on the bus, she wasn't a hypocrite. She might have been, I don't know whether she had anything to drink or not, but she was getting it off her system. You know what's funny on the internet now? They've got right-wing watch. And the left, they've got the right-wing watch. The right, they've got their left-wing watch. They got Jew watch. They got all these watch sites. It's they create shows off of this stuff, get all excited about it, you know, and then they talk about each other and tell what rats each other are and so forth like that. Nothing ever gets solved. Well, I've been tuning around the AM type radios and FM talk shows. I guess the big story today is rehashing this Hillary Clinton and her emails. Who gives a shit? Do you give a shit? Of course they do all this kind of stuff. They cheat and they screw and they just break the law every day, these politicians. So to think that, oh my God, Hillary broke the law? Well, her husband broke the law. Her husband was a hired killer. Killed all kinds of our Serbian friends. Droned them. Did all kinds of bad things. And but now, you see, this is what's to keep you distracted. These talk shows are to keep you totally distracted on bullshit items like Hillary. Does it make any difference whether Hillary runs for president or not? Don't make a goddamn bit of difference. You got to look beyond to the system and how it's really run. Who's at the top and all that stuff. Hillary's a long, long way from the top. But if you want to get on the radio and call these stations and cuss her out and all that kind of stuff, be my guest if it makes you feel better, but it doesn't change anything. The Rush Limbaughs, all of these guys. I, once in a while, tune them in just for a couple of minutes and listen to their bullshit, and then I hang up. And what's interesting is Alex Jones, out of a whole list of all these national talk show hosts, Alex Jones has the highest amount of listeners. Says he had, I don't know, 30 million or some crazy ass. Now, when Alex Jones can brag about 30 million listeners to that freak show he runs... That paranoid show, they're coming to get us. Yeah. They came to get us yesterday, now they're coming again today. If he's the top vote-getter and listener-gatherer in the country, just think of what mentality is feeding into that. Alex Jones, he's setting the pace. A little bit scary, isn't it? Alex is like the boogeyman. Or the other side, I guess, use him as the boogeyman. The boogeyman said this, the boogeyman said that. Sort of like Freddy on Elm Street. You got to have a boogeyman. They try to keep all the balls in the air, a whole bunch of balls in the air, with stories about the Iranians going to kill you in your sleep. Now the Venezuelans are a major threat to the United States, according to the U.S. State Department. And if you want to look for a rotten, mean criminal outfit, it's the State Department of the United States. It's the worst. Almost every bit of shit comes out of the State Department. So, in any changeover in this country, the first thing that would be taken care of and eliminated in its present form, for sure, is the State Department. And I think they've committed so many crimes, there are so many criminals in the State Department, they'd have to be done away with. Just like Castro did in Cuba after he won the revolution. He herded all those bastards into the big soccer arena and shot them all. I watched it on television. It was on TV, black and white TV. And the Chinese do that too. And I don't see anything wrong with that. People who have done such bad things against their system and the people, I think I just heard where a billionaire had been executed in China. Good for them, because these billionaires are always robbing the people and screwing them up and getting them into wars and everything else. So I have no problem with that. I actually don't have any problem with ISIL grabbing that French pilot and burning him up. That French pilot was bombing and strafing and killing innocent people. Who knows how many hundred people he killed in his little airplane where he's up there supposedly safe. Well, once in a while they get a hold of these guys, and I don't see any problem with ICE and him. And but you see, people don't learn a lesson. They say, oh, that's horrible. That's absolutely horrible. That's not civilized. You see, civilized is firebombing Tokyo, firebombing Dresden, droning people, droning wedding parties. That's acceptable. But when the people, the peasants, so to speak, grab a hold of people and take care of them, that's horrible. They're not fighting fair. They're not fighting fair. Oh, shit. I'm going to send out to you after a while an MP3 file, the latest stuff from Rogue Progressive. I still say he does a really damn good job. We disagree totally on race, but on occupation of foreign countries and hurting people all over the world and stealing their goodies and environment and banks and predatory capitalism, we see eye to eye. And so I'm starting to compile more of these excerpts from his show, and not only will I send that out to you, but we've got a special place up on the website for Rogue Progressive. So he puts it out there the way I like to hear it put out, about these sons of bitches in Washington and these bankers and Netanyahu and all that kind of stuff. What is it about the right wing that makes you stupid? Not just the regular right wing conservatives, but the right wing racial people. They may be ill-informed before, but somehow when they join up with the right-wing racial cause and get with these Mickey Mouse leaders, they go stupid. And it's like a virus. They become more stupid and more stupid until they self-destruct or something. Here's a note from one of our people about Craig Cobb. It was stuff I sent out to you about Craig Cobb. Craig Cobb is a very intelligent guy. I couldn't believe it when I couldn't talk sense to him. I tried to help him. I tried to help him in Leith. I couldn't get him out of that right-wing mold with all those losers. This is a note I received. If I were Craig Cobb, I would have went 100% underground, ghost wool. Instead, he played right into the system's hands. Now, he'd been pretty much ghost wolf before, even when he was living in a terrible condition there in Canada. He was lone wolf. Leith was a mistake. Well, you can say that again. This nigger talk show DNA test was a mistake. It sure was. I've heard Cobb a few times. He seems like a pretty intelligent guy. However, his right-wing love affair with thinking guys like Shoup, Plastic Man, Glenn Miller, give me a break. This scene is nearly 100% out of sync with how I relate to the struggle. Listen to Metzger. Quote, we lost that round, now move on, unquote. Cobb could have been an asset to the struggle. Instead, he is playing this kike chess game. And the past 2 years have been a checkmate for the enemy in relation to Cobb's tactics. I'm sure nothing pleases our opposition more. They will eventually go after him again, and unfortunately will probably be successful. I've come to believe that with a heavy heart that guys like Cobb are hurting the racialist struggle rather than helping it. Yeah, they are, especially if the virus that they seem to carry spreads to other people. Come on, join up with me. Join up with these outfits and we'll get something done. You bring the flags, I'll bring the guns, and boy, we're going to do it. It hasn't worked in all the time I've been involved in this struggle. It never worked. But yet, people are still swooned into it, and they fall for it. And once they do, just get away from them because they'll drag you down with them. I see a lot of house nigger Jews are jumping on over John, what's his name, on the John Stewart show. It was funny. If you didn't see it or didn't hear it, Wendy said that that was the longest line of people lining up to give a guy a blowjob in years. It's when the congressman all lined up for him. In fact, I emailed my congressman and said about the same thing. How far back were you in the line to give Nitwit a blowjob? He hasn't replied. Well, I see a New York, Rochester, New York firefighter recruit fired for Jew bashing. In other words, he was critical of Jews. A fire recruit in New York has been fired after posting a video containing offensive remarks. That could be almost anything when it comes to Jews. Joel Ramirez was fired by the Rochester Fire Department after officials received information that the video that contained anti-Jewish material. The recruit recently participated in an online video containing insensitive remarks about the master group, Jews. The Rochester Fire Department is well respected, professionals and inclusive organization. Recruit firefighters are trained to be professional at all times to respect diversity of their fellow firefighters. In other words, a kiss ass. And all the residents there are sworn to protect and serve. You just cannot criticize Jews. I tell you that, you go off and do it. And all the residents there are sworn to protect and serve, according to a statement issued by the department. Of course, the department heads are afraid of getting fired themselves. The actions of the recruit in question did not rise to the high standards set by the Rochester Fire Department, which prompted his termination under the terms of his probationary employment. That's the way they keep everybody under their thumb, where you can be fired at any time for some little stupid thing. James Smith, City Rochester Director of Communications, told Wham reporters, whoever Wham is, Wham's a Jewish paper, and this Jewish paper online is just bragging their ass off about they got another non-Jew fired, man. Well, it just stick around. It's building up. It's building up. These people think this is going to go on forever. Instead of putting a video online, I'm sure there could be much worse things happen. Maybe that's what happened in Eastern Europe before the roof caved in. People just got sick and tired of it. Probably a lot of crooked landowners, Jews, and bankers and everything like that. And they finally said, fuck this, especially the Polish. Now, in case you've purchased one of those expensive Apple gold watches that are supposed to sell anywhere from $500 to $10,000, you might want to hear this and what the Jew perspective is on the Apple Watch.
What kind of reality will the Middle East wake up to the day after Israelis go to the polls? I'm Eileen Prusher.
And I'm Gilad Halpern. Join us on Tuesday, March the 17th for 2 hours of live coverage as the polls are closing.
Today is the big day for Apple fans. We've been geeking out for some time. Finally, Apple is going to announce the launch and the final details of the Apple Watch. With us today is Rusty Brick founder and CEO Barry Schwartz, who is making Jewish apps for the Apple Watch and can tell us a little bit about what we might expect from the device. Barry, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So, Barry, you've made with Rusty Brick all sorts of really cool apps for other devices before. What do you have in store for the Apple Watch?
So we're experimenting right now with the Apple Watch by giving a glance at some of the components that we've built for the Android devices, the iOS devices, even Google Glass, specifically things like when you should pray for the day, finding kosher restaurants, and also being able to get a quick glance at different brachas or tefillahs.
So how does the watch in specific more attuned to these kinds of applications than, let's say, a smartphone?
Well, the smartphone sitting in your back pocket, it's not always out and ready. If you get a little buzz on your wrist, you can quickly take a glance at that and see while you're sitting at a meeting or while you're, you know, out and about or driving your car that, oh, no, you have to say or you have to pray afternoon services, midday services at a certain time. So, I mean, it's much more discreet. It's much more available. And you can give people a quick snippet of what they need to do at a specific time throughout the day. Like you would, they would constantly check their watch for different things. This would actually give them, you know, contextual and geographic relevant information based on where they are, when they are, in a little quick glance.
So there are any other features of the watch that sort of help broaden the way that these things work, other than the fact that it's on your wrist and can give you a little tap, a way to interact? Or is it more of just, okay, this is a quick way to glance and look and learn about what's happening without having to make an active effort?
Well, that is the main thing, is the quick glance, because Apple says, or there's some reports out there that Apple's been, you know, pushing out there, basically saying that when you have the Apple Watch on, you're going to use your phone a lot less. People are not going to take out their phone as much. It's going to be much more active. They're going to be looking at their watches way more than they would their watch, than they would their iPhone or their mobile device. So obviously, it has pretty much the same exact type of features, geo, and all those types of smart features that you would have on your phone, but it's much quicker to glance at, and it actually will vibrate on your wrist as opposed to a push notification, which would vibrate the phone itself. The big question is, will the rabbis permitted on Shabbat or not? So that will be interesting to see how Apple implements a off switch, I guess, so it doesn't track your location, it tracks as you're walking. And stuff like that. So that would be interesting to see how rabbis handle that.
Interesting. So, Barry, can you tell us a little bit about how you got into this business of making Jewish apps for the most cutting-edge technology, the most cutting-edge consumer technology out there?
Right. So when Apple, or I guess Steve Jobs, announced the first iPhone, which didn't support any third-party apps, it just had Apple-specific apps on it, not apps by third-party developers, my brother and I, who own the company at Rusty Brick, were thinking, like, why can't we build something that's smart that will say what you have to pray that day? It knows if it's, you know, Rosh Chodesh. It knows if it's a special holiday. It knows what time of day it is. Like, the phone knows all this information. Why can't we program a smart prayer book, a smart sitter, that shows you that information when you open up the sitter at that exact time? And as soon as Apple announced that they're going to support third-party developers to build applications, we went ahead and started building the first smart sitter for a smartphone. And that smart sitter was our first venue, our first, you know, venture into, I guess, iOS apps. And then from there, we built probably close to 30, 40 different Jewish apps for iOS and Android. And now, obviously, we also built some apps for Google Glass, which is kind of extinct at this point, but we think Apple Watch will be the next big thing.
Yeah, understandable. And certainly for people who keep kosher, who maybe need to keep track of how long it's been since they've eaten milk or meat, it would be nice to be able to sort of tap at your watch and say, okay, you know, remind me in 3 hours.
Definitely.
One last question that I have. Are there any sort of interesting features about the Apple Watch? By the time this airs, people are probably going to know everything already, but was there any sort of interesting feature that you found when you were using the API to put all of this stuff together?
Well, one thing that was a little bit surprising was that we believe that you have to have an iPhone to power the Apple Watch. So the apps themselves on the Apple Watch, you need a companion iPhone app to actually power a lot of the app itself.
Mm-hmm.
But the hardware itself, they don't really let us tie into yet at this point, so we're actually in a wait-and-hold period. Most, I would say 99% of developers are in a wait-and-hold period, just like you guys are, to see what Apple will announce. They gave us definitely a developer kit that we can actually design stuff with and play around with, and this is how we came up with our concepts on our website at rustybrick.com. But hopefully
that is unbelievable. Don't know when to do all their Jew religion stuff. They're just as enslaved to that crap as the Christians. So I wonder if they're building apps for the Christians for their Apple Watch. Very interesting. I understand they're buying up a bunch of these and they're going to give them to the Israeli military so that each one of those people will know what time that they need to set off their rockets and drop their bombs on the Palestinians. Yeah, they say that's going to be a big seller throughout the military. Of course, some are more equal than others. All animals are equal, but some are more equal than others. Uncle Samuel has offered $5 million for the return of an American Chew missing in Iran. U.S. Secretary of State John, my wife's rich selling tomato juice, Kerry, marked the 8th year since the disappearance in Iran of Jewish American Robert Levinson with a plea for his safety. And it's going to make some Iranian a lot of money. $5 million. There you go. Well, I guess they're not so joyous in Israel, a lot of people. I guess they're not as happy as what they lead the world to think. There's a lot of poverty. No, not just among the Arabs that live in Israel, but the Jews. Let's listen to this.
In 2011, thousands of Israelis erected tents all along Rothschild Avenue, one of the most expensive streets in Tel Aviv, to protest against the high cost of living. The protest lasted a few months and eventually dissolved. Almost 4 years later, nothing has changed. And now, they are back. Or at least some of them. Shai Cohen is a married and working father of two. Having just turned 40, he can't afford to buy an apartment and doesn't think he will be able to do it in the future. Thus, he decided to celebrate his 40th birthday this year by erecting a tent on Rothschild once again. In the end, a few hundred people followed suit, and suddenly a miniature reflection of 2011 could be seen among the boulevard's trees.
We expect the government to take care of people's needs, but lacking that, we are forced to protest. I think that's why people joined the protest. We'll see how many. But for now, I already made new friends. It's the best birthday ever.
Since Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu took office in 2009, the cost of housing has skyrocketed, with the most basic apartments costing upwards of $250,000 in the main cities. As a result, many young Israelis are leaving the country to live abroad. Naor Narkis lived some months in Berlin last year, where he evidenced the price gap between Israel and other countries by posting the prices of products in Germany on Facebook.
You can come here and ask a lot of people. For me, it's the rent. For someone else, it's the mortgage. For other people, it's the public transportation that it's not too good here. For every person in Israel has his reason to be here. In the past few years, we had tons of protests and a lot of other struggles against the government. Those are signs that they do not work for the citizens, and it's about time that they will start working for all the citizens, all of them, all the politicians, all the parties.
Naor came back to Israel and also pitched a tent alongside Shai's on Rothschild. Although it's tempting to leave, he thinks it's important that Israelis stay here to bring a change from within.
I came back to Israel because I wanted to start a change here. I know that not all Israelis can move to Berlin. Not everyone has two citizenships, and I love to live here. I want to live here. This is my place. This is my language. My family lives here. I want to be here, but I want to import the conditions from Berlin to Israel.
Even though the 2011 protests didn't really affect the cost of living, they created a social awareness and untapped a deep frustration in society that can still be felt today. The fact that Israelis are leaving their country raises the question if Zionism has effectively backfired as Guy, a rather angry bystander, points out.
Everyone here has a child at home that suffers. Why? Because he has no future. It's impossible to get 140 paychecks to buy a house. If in 70 years Zionism hasn't been able to build enough houses, then something isn't right here.
The comeback protest was quickly surrounded by sympathizers and aggravators, some of which touched upon the big and small questions of political science in civilized debates. And others, not so much. Also among the tents were some of the former residents of Tel Aviv neighborhood Givat Amal, who were forcefully evicted from their homes in order for a couple of tycoons to erect high-rises. Mali Alfasi is one of those residents.
Some people have been compensated and others haven't. There are 82-year-olds on the streets, 1-year-olds, people of all ages, and after living there for 67 years.
Alfasi is now a member of a new political force called the Temporary People's Team, which will be running for parliament in the upcoming elections. Their intention is to allow the people to weigh in on parliament decisions via surveys and applications. Also in the team is Rafi Rotem, who worked for 20 years in the government's tax department. What he saw there made him quit and decide to become a whistleblower.
I worked for the government until I realized that in fact I was working for the mafia, tycoons and criminals, and not for the state nor anyone else.
Some may say that the protest is poorly timed with the elections around the corner, but large-scale social protests cannot be planned. They are spontaneous and unpredictable. So whatever happens, should this protest touch a nerve and grow, or should it go down as a minor ruffling of feathers, it would be important to remember that it started off as nothing more than a birthday party. This is Paul Sanchez reporting for TLV1.
So the myth goes on that the Jews take care of their own. They sell out to the big shot Jews and as the woman said, the mafia. And you know, like I said years ago, the official stats from New York City was that 250,000 Jews live under the poverty line in New York City, and I'm sure there's a lot more now living under the poverty line. So all this Jewish cohesion and sticking together crap is just, they don't stick together any more than anybody else does. And Israel has the seeds of its destruction built in, and it will gradually, due to demographics and so forth, it will be no more. And of course, if ISIL has their way, it will become part of the caliphate. What about the chemical secrets of the Iraq war and how our guys got smeared with mustard gas and everything else as they tried to evidently destroy this stuff? Let's listen to this. Hold on.
These are the participants and victims of a secret chapter of the Iraq War.
On our way back to our FOB, which is FOB Falcon, we started getting sick, noticing a horrible smell in the cab of our vehicle.
We each had pinpointed pupils, which is a telltale sign of nerve agent exposure.
We hit it with the M8 paper, and it instantly became positive for mustard agent.
The United States did not find what the Bush administration predicted when it invaded Iraq in 2003, an active weapons of mass destruction program. But during almost a decade of occupation, American troops repeatedly encountered and quietly destroyed thousands of aged chemical weapons. The discoveries clustered around Iraq's former chemical weapons production center, an area now under the control of the Islamic State. the weapons found in hidden caches were in makeshift bombs, wounded Americans and Iraqis in at least six separate incidents. Most of this was kept secret, including from Congress, from those most at risk, and from doctors who had organized their care. Many victims of chemical agent exposure, American troops from the cat-and-mouse contest against improvised bombs, were denied military honors or medical care. The perils were a consequence of arms sales and foreign policy choices of long ago. During the 1980s, Saddam Hussein developed robust chemical weapons programs with extensive foreign support. Rockets that would hold nerve agent were provided by Egypt and Italy. Tens of thousands of artillery shells, shipped to Iraq from Europe to be filled with mustard agent and Western-built production lines, were of American design. As Mr. Hussein's chemical munitions stockpile grew, his forces used these weapons repeatedly, including against Iranian troops and Iraqi civilians. Iraq suffered defeat in Kuwait in 1991. The United Nations scoured its bases and production centers to destroy the country's chemical warfare programs.
My fellow citizens, at this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger.
The Bush administration, saying that the United Nations inspections had failed, argued that Mr. Hussein still hid an active program. The thousands of chemical munitions that soldiers later discovered showed otherwise. They had been manufactured before the Persian Gulf War more than a decade earlier.
My team leader and I got a call from the headquarters at FOB Fahrenhuggins, basically stating that we needed to respond to an improvised explosive device incident.
Private First Class Michael Yandel served in Iraq in 2004. On May 15th, his ordnance disposal team investigated a makeshift bomb in southwestern Baghdad.
Tom, thank you. Thank you.
As the occupation dragged on, improvised explosive devices became one of the primary weapons used against American troops and the main cause of their wounds. Many were built from conventional high-explosive munitions that had been left unsecured after the invasion.
That looks like some kind of shell.
When troops found bombs or weapons caches, explosive ordnance disposal technicians were sent to destroy them and to gather the remnants for evidence.
We saw that there was a round in the middle of the road, and we sent our robot down to investigate and got video footage of what appeared to be a rusted out, cracked open 155mm explosive round.
PFC Yandel and then Staff Sergeant James Burns put the broken shell in their truck. On the drive back, they sensed something was wrong.
We started getting sick, noticing a horrible smell in the cab of our vehicle, and trying to decide what that smell was and what was causing us to get sick, and we thought it might be a chemical round, trying to play it off as there's no way possible.
By the time they reached their base, their pupils had narrowed to pinpoints, one indication of nerve agent exposure. The shell in their truck had held sarin.
It was very surreal. One just doesn't really expect to deal with nerve agent, I guess, and not then.
Before the war, military planners had prepared for the possibility that Mr. Hussein would fire his chemical rockets and shells. Those attacks did not happen. Dr. Dave Edmund Lounsbury is a retired colonel in the Army Medical Corps. He helped organize plans to treat victims of large-scale chemical attacks.
We were in Iraq. We had this half-baked protocol. We had our mop gear. We waited for these weapons of mass destruction, A, because we were curious, B, because we wanted to get rid of this god-awful gear, and C, because we were anticipating these casualties. And none of that happened.
That planning focused on one element of Iraq's presumed stockpile.
They were very confident that the chemical weapon that we would encounter for casualties in Iraq was going to be mustard, which is otherwise known as sulfur mustard.
Specialist Andrew Goldman served in Iraq in 2008. On August 16th, his three-man disposal team answered a call near Camp Taji, 20 miles north of Baghdad. An American infantry patrol had found buried artillery rounds, not knowing that many of them contained sulfur mustard. This footage shows another team preparing to destroy recovered munitions in Iraq. Specialist Goldman's team prepared a similar demolition. The explosion left a blast crater, which the team approached.
Anytime you dispose of anything like that, you want to go down and check, make sure everything went away. So we go down range and we look, and we have a lot more rounds than what we started with. You can see cracks in the side of the crater where you can see rounds still stacked up on top of each other.
Here, Specialist Goldman inspects the blast crater.
Yeah, I say we used not the hole.
Hard to get in and out of?
Yeah, I just...
The team now had more mustard shells to destroy. They asked the nearby infantrymen to stack them for demolition.
So that's the first time they asked us to help with something like that, because there were so many.
Sergeant Philip Duquette was an infantry team leader. He formed part of a human chain to move the shells as the disposal team pulled them from the crater.
As I'm handing a round up, just the oily, reddish substance just kind of pours out of the round as I'm handing it up to my teammate. And Eric, Sergeant Dooling, said, hold on just a minute. Just as a precautionary measure, we already had one scare today where we thought it was Kim. It was already on our mind. So he went to the truck and got some more M8 paper. And when I tested it this time, it was an obvious positive.
This shows an Iraqi disposal team practicing what is known as a hasty decontamination. At the blast crater near Taji, Staff Sergeant Eric Dooling ordered the soldiers to pull back and clean up. His team put on protection suits to finish the job. Footage taken by the infantry on the perimeter shows the destruction of the chemical shells. Exposure symptoms soon appeared.
We got out, we washed our hands, we didn't think much of it. We was driving back, my knife was on my leg, on my right thigh, and it was irritating me, so I thought it was my knife. I went to bed, woke up that morning, with a small blister.
Sergeant Duquette's blister grew to the size of his fist. The medics acted quickly. He and another soldier were rushed to a military hospital, then flown to Germany.
Sustained large painful blisters.
By then, the blister covered his upper thigh. His medical records are explicit. He had been exposed to mustard agent. None of this was known to Sergeant Dooling's team as they began suffering on another base. The clinic where they sought care seemed unprepared to treat them.
I actually had one doctor say, well, if you're not defecating on yourself or foaming at the mouth, there's nothing we can do for you. And I said, that's great, because if we were like that, it'd be nerve agent, we'd be dead.
The next day I wake up and I look like I had a complete body sunburn, just red in places that have never seen the sun. The first doctor I saw told me that I wasn't hit with mustard agent, and she said because I wasn't throwing up or I wasn't sick or showing, you know, severe blistering and stuff like that.
For 2 weeks, the wounded soldiers received only minimal treatment.
The blister on my butt cheek had gotten a lot bigger, and I'd also had blisters forming on my thighs. They were large up top, and they started getting smaller as they went down.
Some other people in the unit were like, this is not right, these guys should be looked at. So we took pictures of Goldie, wrote down our symptoms, and we sent through back channels back to the States.
At last, the military's medical system woke up. Sergeant Dooling's three-man team was flown from Iraq, but told not to discuss the incident.
When we got to Walter Reed, we were there a few days, and they called us in and said, you've been exposed to mustard agent.
All of us came up positive for having HD mustard, distilled mustard, in our bloodstreams.
Dr. Lounsbury had been reassigned to Walter Reed, part of a small group of doctors monitoring casualty reports from Iraq and Afghanistan to prepare a textbook on treating battlefield trauma. The chemical warfare cases were not circulated to him and his peers.
I never personally attended a case of chemical injury. I never heard about a case of chemical injury, and I never met any colleague who had seen a case of chemical injury. If medical command had been made aware of chemical casualties, that would have been a wildfire notification, and medical facilities would have made the proper preparations.
The long-term effects of mustard exposure are not fully understood. Potential consequences include scarring of the airway and cornea, infertility, and increased risk of cancer. After the 2004 sarin incident, the Army issued new orders for the treatment and tracking of chemical exposure patients. Many victims did not receive the required standard of care.
I still have residual blisters every now and then. I still have a lot of trouble breathing. I have a constant headache. I haven't not had a headache since 2008. Sometimes it gets worse, sometimes it's not so bad.
Sergeant Dooling suffered an array of health issues, including breathing problems that required surgery in 2013. He believes these difficulties were caused by sulfur mustard.
They cut my upper jaw and broke my lower jaw and moved everything forward and then cut out right here and pulled the tongue muscle forward to help stretch out everything in my throat to open it up so I can breathe easier.
All three members of Sergeant Dooling's team were nominated for the Purple Heart. The Army denied the awards. The United States suppressed knowledge of the thousands of chemical weapons its soldiers encountered in Iraq.
If the Allies had found weapons of mass destruction, and more to the point, if Americans had been injured by them, it strikes me as though that might be something you would make a deal, big deal about. These patients would have been celebrities in their own right because they were chemical casualties. But there was no such report.
Only thing I can think of is politics. Doesn't jive with the story they wanted.
Well, boys and girls, that's just mustard gas. Mustard gas is not the worst. The sarin gas is terrible. Sarin gas, Hitler had it. Germans developed it. He could have stopped the Russian army in their tracks if he had wanted to use it. But that doesn't even touch on depleted uranium poisoning, which they're not talking about. Nobody wants to talk about it. A lot of these real vicious crimes by veterans is depleted uranium poisoning. I think that the man who shot the fellow there in Texas, the sharpshooter, was probably not only had PTSD, but I think he had probably depleted uranium. Of course, I have no way of knowing that one way or the other, but I suspect that because that type of behavior is the way it acts on people once they've been, once they've had it, it's in their system. Now, the next day or so, I'll play a show about depleted uranium, which I recorded two or three years ago, and I played it around quite a bit. And I've made DVDs out of it and handed it out to a lot of veterans. But here again, everybody's got their head in the sand. They don't want to hear about it. The more I yelled about it, the more people gave me trouble. So that's the story there. But it brings the main question. Your government's more dangerous to you than people in other countries. It's the government that's killing you. One way or another, they set you down in occupied territory, some place where the people don't want you, for non-emergency reasons, and you get killed either by those people who say, piss on you, you're not coming into our country, or the weaponry and all the kinds of things that the government screws up on. Remember the guys that got electrocuted just taking a shower because of these companies, these private companies that build all the showers for the GIs over there? Didn't do it right. You have no reason, as far as I'm concerned, to be very patriotic to this system. You can be patriotic to your land and your family and your area. But as far as being attached with this patriotism to the Washington or anything like that, I lost that a long time ago. Well, I see Plastic Man David Duke's YouTube channel's been is being shut down, so he's sending out an emergency appeal. Send me money. It's always the case. He says, "This is the most important letter I've ever sent to you." Now, I've seen several letters like that from Duke in the last 30 years. "Zionists have launched an all-out brutal effort to wipe out my powerful world-changing videos in YouTube. Without your help, we will lose our greatest tool to expose and depose these tyrants. Yesterday, they began their attack by banning my video, previewing my very soon to be published world-changing new book, Illustrated Protocols of Zion." I'm not going to read the rest of it. It's a typical, I don't know who wrote that up for him, but anyhow. False front, whether you believe it or not, false front. In fact, the similarities between him and Morris Dees are very close on a whole bunch of issues. Yep, it is. But I no longer plead with people about the rat hole they're putting their money down with Duke if they're so stupid as to think that he is really, really the courageous guy he says he is. If they believe that, well, let him go. Let him go. He's been outed dozens of times. Outed dozens of times. But he still managed to get some followers. And please, David, dump that doctor shit. You know, two or three of the leaders in the right-wing, racial, anti-Jew, conservative struggle have... They'd always go out and get themselves a cheap doctorate, either out of Poplar Mechanics or someplace. Used to get a doctorate for, you know, $10 and write in and get a doctorate. I think that now he's going to, he says he got his over there in Eastern Europe or Austria or someplace. Yeah. Why do you have to have the doctor label to be smart person, educated person, self-educated and so forth? What is that? Why you got to have that doctor shit? Well, that's it for today, Tears Day, and I'll be back tomorrow on Wotan's Day, David Lane's favorite day. And until then, give me your mouth shut. I have nothing to say. Give me a lawyer. And remember, I have used court-appointed attorneys quite well in times past. So anybody tells you that all court-appointed attorneys and people like that are bad, and they're not good lawyers, you know, they are. A lot of them are very good lawyers, so... don't go out and spend a fortune and all the family jewels hiring a lawyer that may be even worse. I remember most of those conservative right-wing lawyers are so behind on the law that you wouldn't want them as a defense lawyer. So you're better off to get some, get yourself a Jew boy, because he's got something to prove. Okay, I'll see you tomorrow.